Welcome to the C Word, the Conservatives podcast. Today we're talking about bioplastics. I'm Jenna Mathiason, an objects conservator based in Carmarthen in Wales.
And I'm Solange Masher. I'm a book conservator based in Sheffield in England.
And welcome to the episode, guys. We have a special guest host with us today that we're going to let them introduce themselves. Please go ahead.
Hello, my name is Panos, and I'm a conservation scientist. I'm currently doing my PhD in bioplastics here at the OU Milton Keynes. And I'm really excited to have this opportunity to talk to you. I follow your podcast and I'm really excited to take part in it.
Yay.
And talk about bioplastics, a very fascinating and yet somehow strange material.
Mm. Oh, I love it. I'm looking forward to it because I feel like I definitely need more knowledge on this. So this is very exciting. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
I think I won't be alone in feeling like plastics is a bit of a kind of black hole of knowledge that I'm very scared of, in that I kind of close my eyes and pretend it's not happening.
I used to feel exactly the same.
I'm very comfortable with the materials that I specialize in, and I don't really have to deal with plastics. But, you know, they come along and they're more common, they're everywhere. And also just in my personal life as well, like as a person, Panos helpfully sent through some information about plastics beforehand. And I was reading it and I was thinking, why don't we learn about this at school? Just in terms of knowing what bin to put the plastic in when you're recycling, or, you know. So, yeah, I think it's an important topic as well.
No, it totally is. I actually did like a little outreach thing a couple of weeks ago, which was it was really more of a toy hospital, but a lot of toys are made of plastic. So really it was talking around plastics, like what is a plastic and how do they age and all of those things, just to get people thinking about it. Because people sort of think either plastic's bad. And it was quite funny because people did avoid me thinking I might be an environmental like protester or something. It's like, I'm literally here to talk about your old toys. It's okay. I'm not scary. But sort of introducing people to the concept of different plastics and that they are different types. And, you know, they also degrade differently because they're all made from slightly different things. And it's plastics tends to be lumped together as one big thing. And really, there are so many different types that it's just, it is a lot. And it's crazy that we don't talk about it more, to be honest. But yeah, bioplastics is then a subgenre of that. I don't know how new I would describe bioplastics to be. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Firstly, I would like to totally agree with you and say that absolutely plastics isn't something that comes in many forms. And also what I'd like to say, it's a complex object as well, right? And I think part of the problem is that conservators or the museum doesn't fully understand this object because it comes in many forms. And it's basically a byproduct that can incorporate many other materials, such as inorganic as well. Mm. And unfortunately, sometimes they also get a bad rep as well. The first thing that comes about plastic is that pollution.
Yeah.
But it's not just like that. They help through the economy and everything, and it's all the way around us, not only, and that's why I believe they're so important as well, because we can see in technology, agriculture, everywhere.
Well, yeah, one of the things I was reading about food waste is that actually the plastic that is wrapped around fruits and vegetables, we can regard them as being really bad for the environment, but actually sometimes they contribute to us not wasting food because it lasts longer, or it's protects it in transit, and therefore you're not having to grow as much food in the first place or throw as much out.
I often have arguments with people about that because but it's all about supply chains in those sort of instances, right? Like if your cucumbers are, I don't know, grown in Spain, then yeah, they need to be in plastic to be shipped that far to make it to, in this particular instance, I was arguing with someone in northern Sweden who was like, I need my cucumbers to be in plastic. And I'm like, do you? We grow cucumbers in Sweden.
Yeah, see, and then there's another point.
But it's all about why it's useful. And in some cases it is. Sometimes plastics is the best option or the only available option or the only one that makes it cheap enough to be doable. So it is a tricky thing, really, as a societal thing.
But just to kind of start things off for those of us who are less familiar with plastics anyway, what exactly are bioplastics and how do they differ from traditional plastics?
That's a very interesting question. And basically, bioplastics can be biodegradable or both. However, they can also come from fossil fuels like PCL, which is polycarbolactone, which complicates definitions. Mm-hmm. Unlike conventional plastics, which are derived entirely from petroleum, bioplastics can be partially or fully sourced from renewable materials.
Mm, like corn syrup and
what? Yeah, starch, corn. Yeah, exactly. So the diversity in definition and properties often leads to confusion about their sustainability and challenges in their conservation as well, right?
Mm.
Example of bioplastics may be easily come across include polylactic acids, which is PLA, which is commonly used in 3D printing and packaging. Mm-hmm. Starch-based plastics found in disposable cutlery or carrier bags. And like I mentioned before, PCL, sometimes used in medical application or as a flexible component in design object as well.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Yes, these materials may look and feel like conventional plastics, but they behave differently over time, especially under environmental or museum conditions. This makes understanding their identity and properties vital for stakeholders, practitioners, designers, and conservators alike.
Yeah. Mm.
So adding to this confusion in the way some bioplastics are mislabeled or market using vague or misleading terms as well.
Greenwashing?
Yeah. Well, for instance, products may be sold as biodegradable when they actually require industrial composting facilities to break down. Others are branding under the names like bioresin, even though they may contain only a small percentage of bio-based content or behave just like traditional plastics. Such terminology can mislead both consumer and professional, make it harder to make informed decision about materials.
Mm, yeah, that's tricky. I suppose on the bright side, as an objects conservator coming across many different things, because bioplastics are a little bit newer, I feel like the information is still there for looking at, okay, this type of toy that was made last year was always made of this particular type of plastic. Like, I feel like the information is still there. There's still a paper trail possible, or people alive still to ask what on earth they use in the production, assuming they want to reveal that, which is, of course, a different thing that maybe people don't want to talk about their production or necessarily want to talk about what sort of things went into their different plastics and stuff like that. But I still sort of feel like there's a newness to the bioplastics that gives me a little bit of hope that it might be researchable.
So, depends what you compare it, because if you compare it, for example, metal or stone, yes, it's very new, but many people assume bioplastics are a modern innovation, but early primer protein delivered plastics such as cellulose acetate and casein plastic date back to the 19th century.
That's true, yeah. Good old cellulose-based ones.
Yeah. The renewed interest in bioplastic is largely due to sustainability concerns with society, or hence the push for an alternative to conventional plastics. Some examples of bioplastic in design and art, which many time appeared in museums and galleries included, which you can find basically in a Google search as well.
And how can you identify whether a plastic is a bioplastic if it's not labeled or you can't get the information from the manufacturer?
I suppose one of the things that was mentioned in an article that you linked to was the little recycling symbol 7, which is technically the category for other plastics, which
makes me feel quite uncertain. Like, well, it can be anything.
No, it's in principle it's the category that annoys me most, because it's just then we couldn't really be bothered. Everything else is like really, really quite exact, and then it's like other, that'll do. And it's like, no, that's a huge category, because other can include things like polycarbonates and ABS, and it's not all necessarily PLAs or bioplastics. It's a really mixed category, but it can give a clue, which, you know, like is something.
No, you're absolutely right. This is one of the issues. But just like traditional plastics, bioplastics can often be identified by non-destructive methods. First, in the early days of plastic, manufactured design materials like cellulose nitrate to imminent expensive and natural materials, such as tortoiseshell, envoy, or horn. So appearance, basically, color, texture, and opacity is a big part of identity. So that still holds true today. Many plastics, including bioplastics, are designed to mimic other materials, which can sometimes give us visual clues as well. Another thing that's very interesting is that trademarks, design numbers, country of manufacture stamps, and general markings actually can include recyclability codes, as what you said, because besides the number 7, sometimes they have two green leaves that say biodegradable.
That's a good clue.
Yeah, can also offer useful information.
I often think of, and this is as a consumer, not thinking about this as conservatorized at all. I often think of almost like, you know, if you look at historic Bakelite, it has a very distinctive visual look to it. Then I think some bioplastics, and I actually don't know which kinds, have this sort of distinct mottled look to them that I find quite interesting. And I don't know how much of that is intentionally made to look like that to make it distinguishable as a bioplastic. I'm thinking of toys and food boxes and stuff like that. Like
almost like a matte kind of matteness.
Yeah, yeah. And a little bit speckly almost. Like, and I don't know how much of that is inherent to the bioplastic that's being used or how much of that is we're trying to make this look different so that people will visually recognize it as different. I mean, that'll still help us in museums.
I think it's a way of making it look like more sustainable somehow.
Yeah, I suspect it's trying to tie into this looks recycled or something, you know, when it's like, really, this is a new bamboo-based bioplastic. But yeah, but I find it interesting that there are some visual clues there,
yeah,
even if I'm not sure if they're genuine.
No, there are good ways to start as a non-destructive procedure, especially in conservation. And I also agree as well. But one thing we must remember is that what we're receiving as a consumer, they are what we call byproducts that have changed over the actual material as well by introducing the combination of what we call plasticizers and basically some inorganic materials as well. For example, if we take the same material, which can be in many forms, for example, if we take a polylactic or PLA knife compared to a polylactic ball, we'd see the one is white or more steady and the other one is more flexible and more clear. So they have some distinct appearances as well, which is very fascinating. And this is due to a couple of the introduction of plasticizer or maybe inorganic materials as well.
So the additives that make that change.
Exactly, exactly. However, there is still some hope for us to identify these materials. It's basically using some odor testing. Came another helpful and surprisingly effective, not destructive technique. So if we gently rubbing the item with a clean cloth and doing some heating, we might be able to understand a little bit of with the smell. And another method is if you don't want to do that, you can actually put it under some hot water for at least 30 seconds and you might detect characteristic smell. And for example, polylactic acid may give a slightly sweet or sugar smell like corn. Syrup?
It does a bit, yeah.
Yeah. Starch base can sometimes smell a little more earthy and musty, and simply when aged or heated. So, however, I have to say that these methods are not foolproof, but they've been used. However, we do have methods of identification, especially in conservation science as well. In recent context, we have Fourier transmission IFR spectroscopy and Raman spectroscopy can help identify chemical bonds in the material. We have nuclear magnetic resonance, which gives detailed molecular information. And also we can use liquid chromatography mass spectrometer that can identify additive or degradation products. So yeah, these scientific methods are essential when we want accurate identification is needed.
I do like the trusting your nose, though. I'm always sniffing books. I think because you then you exercise that muscle, that identification muscle, like the more you interact with your materials. I know it's not always health and safety as well, but
no, but it, yes, absolutely. It's interesting though. And I mean, I feel like it's the thing that I probably get asked most about is like, how do you identify this without destroying it and without taking it to a lab because we don't know where one is or how to get in touch with a scientist?
Yeah.
You know, like in those instances, you know, like those, the sort of almost tricks that like keen plastics collectors use, like hot water and smelling something, like those simple tools can be really helpful, especially in smaller museums and collections that maybe don't get the chance to do this any other way.
Absolutely. I have to agree because it's exactly like you said, not all museums have the ability or the equipment to do it. So they have to rely on other methods as well. And what we also would like to do in our research is our methods to be approachable in many situations. Like if you can do analytical equipment, yes, we can suggest these methods, but if you don't and you need something that can help you identify or get something, is these methods as well, which sometimes you don't have to do anything. It's actually an object is and say, this bag is made out of polylactic acid, and then you're done. You know what you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's good to demystify this as well, rather than shrouding it in level
exactly.
Science.
It's about toolkits, like the MODIP toolkit for plastics is so useful to people because it just helps them think about what break down their sort of looking at things and like going, oh, because it can't be that because it's coloured, or it can't be that because it's not transparent, or it just helps eliminate things a little bit. It's just a really, really good resource. I don't know how much it helps with the bioplastics, but it definitely helps with a lot of the plastics that are currently in collections. And I realized that I phrase it that way because I realized that bioplastics will become the thing that's in our collections.
Yeah, which brings us to 3D printing, perhaps.
I mean, that's we use polylactic acid a lot for, or PLA filament for a lot of our 3D printing. So my other half has two 3D printers. One is resin-based and one is PLA, well, filament-based. It doesn't have to be PLA, but he uses it a lot. And that stuff is in, as we've already mentioned, it is biodegradable, but only industrially. So it isn't something you can put in your own compost. Mm. That wouldn't work. But it does at least make it a slightly more eco-friendly version of these filaments. But yeah, we use that quite a lot, and it does have that smell.
Yeah,
definitely.
3D printing opens up new possibilities for designing with bioplastics. From bespoke research material to innovate product designers. However, they used, like you said, use bioplastics, which have unknown aging properties, and practitioners often lack guidance on how to clean, repair, or store them properly as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's something that I try to remind people about when they're talking about 3D printing is that 3D printing is really a rapid prototyping thing. It's made to make it was meant to make a masters of something that you would then maybe cast in a more durable material or something. But it's just, it's become the thing that makes the thing that we have, because that's what humans do. We will find ways of innovating and find ways of using this that weren't necessarily how they were intended to begin with. So now 3D printers make the actual thing that we have, and that causes interesting problems for us because then that thing is what ends up in our collection. I did sort of toy with the idea whether 3D printed objects in collections, maybe this is actually more of a digital problem, because really everything starts as a file. Maybe it's more useful to keep the file so that you can 3D print it again than it is to keep the actual 3D printed thing that might be degrading very fast. But this is me talking out of my arse here. Like, I don't actually know enough about how long a PLA thing or a bioresin thing, you know, lasts, relatively speaking, depending on its use and once it's in our collections. I don't know enough about that. But it's also like this strays into territory of like, you know, surrogates and replicas and like, what is the true object? Mm. Is it the thing in front of you, or is it the file that's being printed? Because if it's a file that's distributed on the internet that's being printed in hundreds of places all over the world, does it matter where this one was made or when it was made? The file probably matters.
Yeah, that's a very interesting bug that you open. the main questions we have to ask, not about 3D printing, it's about bioplastics is in general, is why we would like to keep them or why we have to put them in a museum. And in the case of 3D printing, why we need to save it, why we don't just make another one. The most fascinating thing about the research, and especially with the collaboration with Modip, is that we're trying to save or to conserve restored material that are designed to degrade.
Yeah.
It's if you think about it, it's the most fight against time I think a conservator has to face, right?
Yes. Let's save the impossible thing.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. So yes, Modip, VNA, Tate and Science Museums are beginning to acquire bioplastic objects from design prototypes to consumer goods. Their challenges include the lack of established conservation protocols, are certain that are outaging, and the misconception that bioplastics are more stable than traditional plastics as well.
Ooh, which is interesting, which is assumption. I was going to say, that wasn't my assumption at all.
People must have done accelerated aging tests on bioplastics.
Yes.
And how did they react?
We already started some thermal accelerated aging tests, but we seen some very interesting results. Mm. And we will move forward to light degradation and humidity and a combination of that, really, really sure. But there is a lot more tests to be done to give some defined answers. Mm. But all I will say is that we get very fascinated results.
Oh, this is tantalizing.
Oh, I want to know.
I know.
How long is your PhD? Come on, when can we know?
We'll have to have a part two.
I'm giving a hint.
Such a tease.
I know.
I mean, I always feel a bit suspicious of accelerated aging anyway, of course, because you're introducing different conditions, heat in particular, that the object is not going to go, it goes through them over time, but it might go through processes in the heating in the oven that might not happen if it's just sitting in a shelf in normal conditions for 100 years.
It can still give you an idea.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I think the main reason why we doing the accelerated aging is to find out what will happen in 100 years' time. Mm. But with changing some of the parameters, you can make the experiment actually longer or shorter, depending what you want to look for. Obviously, in our speculation, we will try to find it what will happen in 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth saying, of course, that even though we test these things in that way and we might have some really interesting ideas of how this works, every object is still unique because it has been subjected to different things or it's a different, slightly different batch of something. So, but this is true of everything that we do in conservation. Like, no two objects are truly the same, not really, because one will have been handled more, one will have been kept in a cupboard for 50 years, whilst the other one was rubbed every day by hands. You know, so it's, you know, it's everything's, each object is always different. It just gives us a good general idea, which is good. That's more information is always better.
No, absolutely, absolutely. There are many different environmental settings. Because we have obviously the museum settings, which can actually differ depending on the collection itself. And we also sometimes, like we said, you will 3D print an object, but then it's left to uncontrolled conditions as well. So there are many interesting questions popping up to what will happen, because my house is not very much good environmental. We have lots of humidity, or I live next to a lake. A very interesting aspect, and what we will do is we're going to try to do environmental conditions in its different countries. For example, Egypt has very high. Ooh. Exactly. Yes. So we're going to do something about that as well to see how this actually degrade in different high levels of environmental condition around the world.
Yeah. That's exciting to me because often it, you know, research can be quite Western centric or like, this is how it works here and in these pristine conditions. And it's like, that's not the case everywhere. That's nuts. So I'm very glad to hear you're doing that. That's amazing.
Yeah, yes, yes, yes. And we're using 3D printing in order to make unique and recognizable to the people as well. It's going to be, again, not saying too much because we're running them now, very, very interesting. To give some results as well.
Really look forward to hearing more about it.
Oh, you've got a survey, haven't you, for our listeners to engage with?
Yes, yes, that is correct. We also create a survey in order to understand a little bit more about the people's needs and what they're looking for. Both, and the survey is actually split in two pathways depending on your answer. Again, I will not spoil too much, but it's actually to both professionals and the public. Let's see also what the people will answer as well. That will be interesting. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really crucial part of some of these discussions, especially when we're looking at plastic objects and things like that. Because I think as museum professionals, we do tend to be quite concerned that there's going to be a big gap where they're like in the historic record where it's like, and this was aeroplastics and there is nothing left, you know, because things just degrade very rapidly.
And then it's also the era of our communications being digital. It feels sometimes like the era where nothing will be left behind.
In some ways. Or if it is, it's microplastics.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not very good to anyone. And I think as museum professionals, we worry a lot about that side of things and feel like, oh, we must save these things because they're everyday things and they're more important to people. But I'm curious if sort of people feel that way. You know, like does the public think that's important or is it... Are they not that bothered? Is it okay that we might not be keeping one of each type of Barbie doll that was ever produced or whatever it is that we're trying to do, depending on the scope of your museum? I think it's really vital that someone is trying to save these things. So that's, you know, where MODIP and Tate and V&A and everything really does good work. But I'm thinking of like small little local museums where the story might be much more about who used the object, like this was a doll belonging to a particular person, it was important because of these reasons. And maybe it's less about the doll as a design object or that sort of thing that in some ways we collect for very different reasons and in very different ways. And sometimes we have to be open about the fact that we might not be able to save everything, whether it's a fossil fuel based plastic or a bioplastic. It's just we might not be able to keep it forever and that's got to be okay somewhere.
But I think people have a tendency to disregard the importance of the everyday objects at the time that they're in use, like, I don't know, Victorian adverts from newspapers. Now they seem very, like, revealing of the real life that people lived, but at the time would be something you'd use as toilet paper.
It's a good point. It's a good point.
Other people would have thought they should go in museums. I don't know.
No. I will definitely agree with that. I think people maybe, and I was to be completely honest, I was one of them. My interest in bioplastics were, things that degrade, good for the environment, and that's it. And now after almost halfway through my PhD, I'm at a party and I'm looking under cups, plastic. Oh, that's plastic. That's bioplastic. Oh, what is it? Can I have a look? I need a sample. It's so much fascinated, but we live in the era of mass production as well. So people see something every day. They tend to disregard it. But if we start from the beginning and say, look, bioplastics are used in medicine. Example, we have the self-absorbent stitches as well. I'd be like, exactly. This is how it all started with medicine and then expanding to the whole area. And we have to remember there's so much history behind an evolution as well, because the reason why we have bioplastic is because there was a need, right? And that need expanded. And yes, the environment is very significant as well. But even within the bioplastic history, we have stages. For example, from potato starts, we went all the way to 3D printing. That takes leaps of advantages and technology. And it used to be, you just said, sorry, your husband owns 2 3D printers.
Yeah.
Be prepared for more. I have 4.
Do you think that's something people will commonly have? Just the average household?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Think about the phone. Think how the phone started.
I think it's interesting because even though they're getting simpler and simpler all the time, there's a fair bit of upkeep and stuff like that. And like they're fairly user-friendly. But I think we're probably quite far from it being so user-friendly that everyone can use one. But I do think that every neighborhood will have one. Everyone will go to the neighbor with the 3D printer and ask them to do something, or maybe even neighborhood hubs, you know, in a more environmentally friendly.
Maybe at the library, the local library.
Yeah, our library already has 3D printers, for goodness sake.
Oh, really?
I can go in there and print anything, you know, if it wasn't for the fact.
Oh, man, maybe mine does. I've not looked into it.
Yeah,
you should check, because actually that's a really common service now.
Oh.
I know at least 4 businesses in town where I can go. You know, they are cropping up everywhere.
I feel like a real Luddite.
Yeah.
So only because I've been experimenting with making tools with them.
Cool.
Yeah, yes. 3D printing used to be a very specific and unique thing, but now as the years go by, it's become more and more consumer available as well. And what I'm really interested in thinking about it is how will that affect the conservation process as well? Because let's go to a frame conservation, right? Let's say if something is chipped or broken, the common use is to create material from gesso and et cetera. And please forgive me if I make something wrong. I'm not a frame conservator, so I don't know.
No, you're right so far.
Yes. But there is now an interesting question. Oh, wait, I can 3D print that with more accuracy in one go and it will fit perfectly. And I can paint it over it to match it as well. So ethically, you can take it off. It will degrade by itself so that they're not causing any harm. And you can glue it as you glue a gesso piece. Mm. And it will be distinct as well. So maybe it's the way going forward if we can understand them better, how they degrade as well. So what do you think? That's an interesting question I would like to ask you as well.
My first thought is that I believe that part of what we do as conservators, depending on our specialism, is that not only are we preserving the objects themselves, but we are also preserving the skills and the craft involved in repairing those objects, because that's really quite closely related to how those objects were initially made. And if we're not using those skills and passing them on and teaching them to the next generation of conservators, then those skills get lost. So that is my main reservation in not using that approach of using the 3D printer. However, the other side is of me is pragmatic and thinks, well, if that's going to work really well, I wouldn't judge anyone for doing it that way. And I like to experiment with it myself.
I think that's a really interesting point. It's interesting because the idea sort of, it's almost a little bit puritanical, isn't it? Like, oh, we do it the traditional way, but it doesn't always have to be the case. And I think it's interesting in maybe cases where the skill has been lost, if you see what I mean, or it's so unattainable. Like, this isn't a real example. So please don't write in dynamic objects conservators, because I know this isn't true. But let's say there's a specific type of clock that there's a single person left in the world that does the cogs for. But we do have 3D scans of them. You cannot get that person because he's in Switzerland and he's very busy and he costs £1 million apiece because he's the only one left in the world. If you have to repair that clock, I don't see an issue with, as long as you choose a 3D print material that works, is hardy enough and is, lasts for a long time, whatever. I don't see a problem then with replicating that part via a 3D printer, because that way you can actually repair that rather than go, this just has to be broken forever because you can't afford the £1 million guy in Switzerland. I think if the knowledge has been lost or is so unattainable, then I think that's absolutely a way forward for that. I think it has its uses is what I'm trying to say.
I went to a really interesting symposium once on the conservation of religious objects, And there was one talk that I remember talked about Japanese in Japan. I believe it was Japan. I'm really sorry if I'm wrong. But I think it was Japan, where they made a distinction between conservation of objects depending on their future use. So if this was an object that was going to go back into a temple, say, and be used in situ, then you would use the traditional materials and repair it that way. If it's an object that is going to be preserved in a museum for kind of more intellectual, cultural reasons, then you would use a more synthetic material, almost as a kind of differentiation. I don't know. This may not be a hard and fast rule, but it was something that was mentioned. I thought that was really interesting, because there is also, I think, a case to be made that, like, sometimes it's quite nice to repair things with something that is a different material. It shows it is clearly a repair. It has, you know, you're not trying to recreate what it once was. It's not restoration.
Yeah, you're not hiding that it was bones broken.
Yeah. And so there again, I think, is a case for the 3D printing.
Yeah, I think that's really a really interesting point. And again, use case is everything. Because I have to approach things quite differently. If something is for a private client and, you know, it's going to be used in their house, then I know that I have to use slightly different materials than I would if it's going in a showcase for 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, like, that, they're very different considerations. So already we're kind of approaching it that way. So I think that's an extension of that, that maybe that's more appropriate in some cases.
I think also what I will add to what Solène said is that I think you're trading skills instead of losing one, because making 3D printing from the design to the execution actually takes a lot of training and trying to do from one start to another, a lot of failure as well. And and I think it's evolving. So I don't think you're losing a skill, you just evolve. Because if you take it as another example, is we used to send papers, letters, written letters to each other. Now we send emails because we evolved to that way. But I do understand also what you said. It's like, if you just start 3D printing everything, there is no, you, for example, if there's a malfunction of 3D printing, you need to know these skills, like create a gesture, how to apply it. So I do get those points, but I was very interested in find out of what do you think, if they were given the case, which one we would choose and why? Because I always think about and I say, oh, yes, why don't we do that?
Mm.
And it's really interesting hearing your thoughts as well on that aspect, because it helps me understand better as well.
Yeah. I think having talked to other conservators sort of casually about this, because sometimes I'll show that I've got some 3D printed tools and they can see the use of those, if you see what I mean, because it's like, that's really useful. You've made them specifically for the task you need. So it's perfect for the thing that you need. But then there's always the hesitation of, but I wouldn't use it in an object because I don't know what the long-term repercussions of using this material inside an object would be. So I think there it comes back to, we don't know how these things will degrade. So a lot of the time we will trust a material that we know really well, you know, like a clay or something that's traditional and it's been around for hundreds of years, so we just know how it works. So we'll be a bit suspicious of a new material for quite a long time until we know more about how it ages. So in many cases, I don't think it's that we don't want to be using it. It's just that we don't trust it yet. I think we're curious, but we need more information before we can be excited.
Just give me a year and a half and I will come back with answers.
Excellent. I'll hold you to that.
100%.
One thing I like about this idea of, I think that in the modern world, many people feel very divorced from the material world and their ability to interact with objects and to manipulate them, again, because they're made of plastic or they're electronic, feel quite mysterious and almost magical. Whereas in the past, people knew how to repair their car, but now it's all electronic and it's too complicated. But the idea that people and young people would get involved in just, oh, I want a thing, I'll go and print it, it kind of rebuilds that kind of connection with making things and useful things. And I'm excited about that.
I think you're right, because I especially if a young person has to be involved in the making of a model on a computer first, whilst that's digital, yes, but you need to understand how it's going to be extruded from the different bits. You need to understand how it's going to interlock. If it's going to move, you need to figure out how it's going to move in sockets before you even build it. It's a lot of thinking. It's actually a very cerebral thing. And then in the end, yes, you'll have a toy that's articulated. You'll have one of those snake things that you just peel off the print bed and it's all snaky. But, you know, you have to understand how it sort of fits together and works first. So I think it is just a different way of making. We shouldn't be scared of that. I think it's just a different thing.
And if people learn more about the plastics themselves by doing this, then it can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a really rewarding experience if someone wants to learn as well. There's also a misconception in the 3D printing community that, oh, I buy 3D printed and I'm ready.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a lot of to go with, but after you go through these obstacles and learning as well, it's a new whole world opening as well.
Yeah, I'm thinking I need to do a course in this or something.
We're actually lending one of our 3D printers to a conservator when we have a small child, because this one 3D printer uses resin and it does get a little bit fumey. So we thought we don't want to use that when we have a very small child. So that one is being temporarily rehomed so they can try out a new technology without any financial risks, really. They have to buy some resin, but that's it. They don't have to buy the printer. They can try things and have a go at making stuff. And actually, I think it's going to be really good CPD for them. And I think it's going to be a really nice thing for everyone involved because they're learning loads of new skills and trying things without necessarily any big risk of failure. They haven't spent £300 on a printer. They've just spent 20 quid on a little jar of resin and they're done. I think it's going to be really nice. But yeah, familiarizing people with these new tools is really important as well. So,
yeah, no, it's a whole new, and that's why I believe it's so important for museum to take advantage of all that and have collect this object as well, because each and everyone has unique technique or unique materials as well. And I believe if we don't start collect them now, it will have a problem later, because if let's say you find the most beautiful 3D object in your collection in a museum, or someone gifted to you and say, oh, my father did this, you can have it, you don't know pretty much anything about it. And it's even harder because you can have a different combination of filaments. Some printers use 3 or 4 different filaments at the same time.
It's getting pretty advanced now.
So you said, and others also do a combination of resin and filaments as well. I believe it is really important to understand these materials and provide some guidance to them as well, I think also. And understanding them and how they behave as well, it will be a massive help to stakeholders and practitioners around the world.
Mm. So you mean if museums start collecting them now, that kind of will give the conservators the opportunity to start learning about them sooner rather than later?
I personally believe that this will be the time now that we experiment with the material and it hasn't advanced to a point that we cannot catch up, will be a good, nice way. For example, we're just mentioning that we have 3D printers in our library. We can print a square, it's a simple square, and just experiment on it. We actually done a lot of experiment with 3D printing as well to understand how these materials behave. We just mentioned aging, but that's one part of it. We have chemical degradation. We also have material restoration as well and how the material behave. We also have interventing conservation, like if it breaks, filaments, colors. So there are so much of the material that we can learn. And there's also green opportunities as well, green chemistry that we can use with the use of gels as well. Most people forget about the use of gels and which are environmental friendly we can use, and mostly conservation gels, like agar and surfactants as well, which is not for a better fit, but we can use that as well. For example, we've been successfully cleaning bioplastic with the use of gels and surfactants.
Oh, nice.
Spoilers now.
I was going to say, now you're just teasing us again.
I know, but a bit of spoilers, yes. And we've actually measured the percentage of success of each of the gel.
Wow, nice. This is going to be such a juicy publication.
Do you think conservators will be having to focus mostly on the preservation side, or do you think there's that people will be able to develop like interventive conservation techniques, like, you know, repairing things? Or
again, yes, absolutely. We in our research, we taking really much consideration of the actual interventive conservation as well. That's why we're doing testing with cleaning methods.
Yes,
and also adhering as well. Mm-hmm. We're hoping if there is time, we also do some filler methods as well. Mm-hmm. If there is time, because there's so much to cover, but I think we will.
You gotta leave something for future PhD students.
That's true. I need to. But yes, we take it very much consideration of interventing conservation, and not just preventing, but interventing as well.
That's always nice, because I feel like that's often missing from what little conservation plastics literature there is. Does tend to focus quite a lot on the preventative, and if anything, sort of being extremely hesitant about anything interventive, like don't touch it, it will explode.
Yeah, or maybe you can't collect it.
I don't think that helps.
You don't know what it's going to do. It's going to turn into acid.
I know, but that's not terribly helpful. So I guess we have to collect these things, and often they have to be presentable enough to be useful and shown to the public and things like that. It's like, actually, sometimes we do need to intervene. How about we talk about that bit?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And this is where the whole conservation of 3D printing comes in mind, because you can actually starting experiment yourself. For example, if you haven't adhered a bioplastic before, you can start by 3D printing, let's say, a square, cut it in half, and try to prepare with basically suggestions that we will provide and see if it works for yourself as well. Because we've done it, we've done the test to prove what works, but it's up to each.
Been a good old fashioned experimentation.
I know. I'm really positive of the hands on experience, and that's what bioplastics can help you with, right? Because let's say you don't have to go straight to the material. This is now the time for experimentation. You can get a bag of 100. PLA knives, and you can experiment on them before you get to the actual big 3D printing ginormous complicated piece you have to restore.
Exactly.
And one thing, I don't know if I mentioned it, the definition of bioplastics is actually has the term may or may not be biodegradable.
Oh, I love it. Swings and roundabouts.
Yeah. Just to add to the chaos.
Adding a bit of spice to our lives.
I would definitely want to hear if there's something, you know, that you'd really like people to know, like most important thing to take away. Or
absolutely. I will say is bioplastic are more fascinating than people give them credit for.
I'll agree with that.
Aww.
I think that's how I close it.
And after that wonderful episode, I thought we would stay on the topic of science. Today I'm reviewing Experimental Design and Scientific Data Analysis by Linda and Philip Skipper, which is a brand new Science for Conservators book. That's right, the 1980s classic is finally getting an overhaul. This is a 2025 Routledge publication in glorious purple. This book aims to demystify the research process, and it's divided into two parts, experimental design and data analysis. So let's start from the top. How do we design experiments? Fittingly, the first chapter is called Why, and in it we start to unpick concepts like hypotheses, aims, objectives, and research more generally, aided by helpful diagrams and flowcharts. Even some humorous illustrations from Phil, which I really appreciated. The next chapter is called How, which deals with methodology as a concept and some of the many, many analytical techniques that you might use as part of an experiment. This chapter has a really good and accessible breakdown of the different techniques available and what they're usually good for, so this is actually helpful on many levels. It's got some good tables for familiarizing yourself with different techniques. I like it. The final chapter in this first section is very logically called How and deals with ethical sampling, what we consider value to be, and scientific rigor. This chapter really brings in the conservation perspective into focus, and I really love that this chapter deals with the sort of fallibility of science, that we don't always get it right, but it's important to try. The second half of the book starts with an introduction to statistics, which is a great refresher if you've done this sort of thing in the distant past. It's the kind of chapter we could all do with glancing at when it's been a while since we crunched some numbers. Goodness knows that's true for me. It still gets a little overwhelming in parts, but you can look at this chapter in chunks and reread bits, go away and mull it over and then come back and read the rest later. You don't need to speed learn statistics. It's not the easiest of subjects. Next up is a chapter on displaying results, which gives us a lot of options for data visualization. Charts, diagrams, and good captions are covered here. Personally, I would have liked even more on this because I'm a total nerd for visualizing data. But this definitely covers all the basics and definitely the most common approaches found in scientific articles. Finally, we've got a chapter on scientific writing, which gives us writing tips, structure suggestions, and audience considerations. I really like that this chapter cautioned against use of artificial intelligence because that really needs to be said in today's increasingly AI-fueled world. Each chapter ends with a couple of suggested exercises, which do have answers in the back. So the book really feels like a classic school textbook in that sense. They're really helpful and are a great addition, so I'm not dissing them at all. It just felt like I was back at school, in quite a nice way. Key features I love about this book. How new concepts are introduced in bold text to make them pop on the page. The amount of personal experiences shared in examples. And the little bits of humour interjected throughout. It really helps when you're speed reading a book, which is definitely not something you're supposed to do. In fact, the intro encourages you to take your time as a reader, and I think that's really great. But as a reviewer, I definitely read this cover to cover, which makes it a little bit more intense. I really like that this book introduces science as an extension of art and craft-based practices. It does a really good job of reassuring us all that this is within our capabilities and already in our skill sets. Honestly, this is the book I wish I'd had 13 years ago as a student. I was left to devise an experiment for my dissertation, and I felt horribly alone in both the design and analysis phases. And this book really would have been gold. And I did science at school. I had a science background. But nothing of the Swedish secondary school science system prepared me for the kind of loneliness that research sometimes throws us into. So this book does help with that. And should you get this? Yeah, I reckon you should. Whether you're a pre-programmed student or a late career conservator, I think this actually has a place on everyone's bookshelf, especially if you find science a little scary. Oh, and as a bonus, this book feels like it's kind of wiped down and how the cover is coated, so you can have this on your grotty workbench and easily clean the covers if you get something on it. I just thought I'd mention that. This paperback version has 138 pages and is available from Routledge for £32.99 British pounds, or a smidge less for an ebook version. Thanks for listening. We're the C-Word, and today you've been listening to Solange, Panos, and me, Jenny. Join us next time for an episode about objects for use. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show, email us at thecwordpodcast@gmail.com, or go find us on social media. We're on almost everything. Intro and outro music is Spring Valley Music, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Additional music and sound effects by Callum Robertson. And as always, this has been a Wooden Dice production.